again, then back to Peter. What am I missing here? Look at the Times. He pointed to the page. Estelle buys the aspirin at 23 minutes past 11, just after she leaves the other women in Fizz. But she doesn't enter her cabin until a minute before midnight, almost 40 minutes later. I've studied the maps. The Crescent General Store is on deck 12, aft of the D elevators. All Estelle had to do was walk 20, 30 feet along a corridor, get into the lift, go down a few floors, and then walk another 15, maybe 20 feet to her door. When I raised my eyebrows at this, Peter said, I've had nothing to do but think about this. I've studied the floor layouts for hours. By now, I could probably navigate my way around this ship blindfolded. What are we talking in minutes? I asked. Even if Estelle took her time, it would take 5, 10 minutes. 15, let's say, if the lifts were especially busy. So why the 40-minute gap? Maybe she stopped to look in a store or something. But she had a bad enough headache that she left the group and went to buy something to get rid of it. Does that sound like someone inclined to do a bit of shopping? Well, I don't know then. Neither do I, but I have a theory. If someone had her swipe-out card and used it to make it look as though she'd gotten off the ship and onto a tender, couldn't that same person have let himself into her cabin with it the night before? Run me through it then, I said. What happened? I think someone spiked Estelle's drink. That's why she was feeling unwell. Whoever spiked it then followed her out of the bar and into the Crescent General Store. Watched her. Perhaps got talking with her. Remember, she's on holiday on a cruise ship. She feels safe. Everything's all lit up and festive. Everyone having a good time floating on the lovely, tranquil Mediterranean. It never occurs to her this is still just like meeting a strange man in a dark alley at the end of the night out. Then he either walks her back to her cabin and follows her in, which would also explain the delayed keycard entry and the unopened aspirin box, or he takes her somewhere else. She has a headache. Maybe he suggests that some fresh air out on the deck would do her good. And then... well... then he does it. There was a beat of silence as we both tried not to picture it. Peter pushed on. If it did happen elsewhere, then afterwards he uses her key to open her cabin door, thereby creating a record of it in the swipe-out activity. Does the same thing the next morning on the tender platform. But where did the passport and the note come in? Well, it throws a wrench in the works, doesn't it? A communication that appears to be from Estelle, sent from the place she supposedly got off the ship. It diverts attention from the celebrate. You think whatever happened must have happened after she went ashore. But do you think... the notes, I mean, are you saying he forced... I think it would be relatively easy for a crew member to get hold of a weapon. That's what I think. Just for a start, you have how many restaurant kitchens full of knives? My stomach twisted at the thought. Now, Peter said, he's covered all the bases. There's no evidence, no body, and no police. Blue Wave says she got off the ship, so their hands are clean. It's the perfect crime. He waits a while, just to make sure. A year later, he does it again. Only this time he selects his victim ashore and then manoeuvres her onto the ship. And this time, her boyfriend finds his way to the husband of the first woman. And when we talk, we learn that we both got a passport with a note stuck inside. This time, someone figures out that the only connection the two women have is him. It seemed a perfect fit for the hole in the jigsaw puzzle, but I wasn't ready to slot it in just yet. Peter looked at his watch. We sail at 6, he said. We'll start the search for him then. I told Peter that now I had to go buy some aspirin. All the not sleeping and the travelling and the heat had conspired to start a thundering in my temples. I listened while he told me where the nearest store was. I assured him there was no need to take me there himself, and then I fled. Sarah dead. Murdered. The worst case scenario, but also the only one we had that made any sense. Her eyes bulging in terror, hands on her mouth and neck, her clothes ripped, her skin bruised. There could be no avoiding it anymore. Holding back the worst thoughts was so exhausting, it was a relief of sorts to give up and let them in. I hurried back down to the deck, blinded by the sun, gasping in the heat, trying to find a way inside as images of Sarah's death went off like camera flashes in my mind. A body falling through the night air. I pushed past a young mother with her troop of three children and their assortment of inflatable swimming pool toys. Streaks of sunscreen glistened on their cheeks. A faint scent of coconut. Dropping like a stone into dark water, lost forever. I clipped the shoulder of a guy close to my own age, wearing board shorts and trying to keep three beers from sloshing. He swung around toward me and shouted, "Hey!" Sarah, lost forever. A Blue Wave crew member with flowers in her hair thrust a flyer in my face. Cold, damaged, and alone. "Why not join us tonight in the Horizon Room for a special screening of..." "Sir? Are you okay, sir?" Up ahead, I saw a set of double doors propped open. I ignored her and made straight for them. I followed the flow of people into a dim corridor. Tasting salt on my lips, I lifted my hand to them and realized that my face was wet. When had I started crying? I put my head down and walked faster. I just needed to get to a place where I could sit down for a second and think. The corridor ended suddenly in a burst of light. I was on a paved garden path now, winding through lush green palms grown tall enough to bend and hang overhead. I could hear piped-in birdsong and the gentle trickle of an unseen water feature. And through gaps in the foliage, I saw the glint of a golden twirling carousel. Above me, I saw what looked like two opposing cliff faces. Cabins, their balconies stacked side by side in row upon row, all the way up to the atrium ceiling. I should never have come here. If Ethan had killed Sarah, what was I supposed to do when I found him? I dug out my phone and powered it up. It had been off since I was back at the airport. Cork Airport. I couldn't take the chance that someone might talk me out of coming to Barcelona because I knew they wouldn't have to try very hard. Now, I needed someone to talk me down. The moment the phone connected to a service, it sprang to life, beeping and pinging as text messages, emails and voicemail alerts came streaming in. Ignoring them all, I went to contacts and scrolled until I found Rose. I spotted an empty garden bench set back from the path. While the call was connecting, I walked over and dropped into it. "Jesus Christ!" Rose yelled when she picked up. "Where the hell are you? Your parents have been losing their shit. They think you're in a river somewhere that you jumped off some bridge out of grief. What the hell, Adam? Didn't we just spend a week of our lives wondering where..." "Rose," I cut in. "I need you to shut the fuck up for a second. Where are you right now? Are you at home?" "I'm in town, Mr. Manners, on lunch. Where are you?" "I'm on the ship, the Celebrate, at the port in Barcelona. It's getting ready to set sail." Silence. Then, "What are you doing, Adam? Why are you there? You're not planning on doing anything stupid, are you? Rose, listen. I met a man. Found him, then met him. Peter. I read all this stuff online, and then I saw that he'd been sent a passport too, and now we're here, and Ethan. That's his name. Cusack found out who the number belonged to, and get this, he works here. He's on the ship right now. The man who... My voice began to waver. Killed her. Rose. Who killed her. Oh God. What if he did? What if she's dead? What am I going to do? The silence was longer this time. Adam, you listen to me, Rose said. Where are you right now? Are you sitting down? Are you alone? I'm on a bench. Yeah, alone. Okay. Start at the beginning. Go slow. Who is the man you're talking about? This Peter guy. I walked Rose through the events of the past few days, remembering the comment about the fiesta, Googling cruise ship crimes, finding out about Estelle, contacting Peter, him telling me he had received a passport and a note too. An identical note, but for the initial. I told her about Cusack giving me Ethan Eckhart's name and that he was working here on the ship. Peter's theory about Ethan, our plan to search the ship until we found him. And then what? Rose asked. What will you do then? I came here because I thought he could fill in more blanks, I said. Move the timeline along. Tell me where Sarah was going when she left him and then go there. But now I don't really know. You need to come home, Rose said. Now. Through the leaves, I saw the carousel come to a stop. A moment later, came the high-pitched voice of a young girl pleading with someone to let her ride it again. This was soon followed by an ear-piercing shriek that suggested her request had been refused. Adam? Rose prompted. I'm here, I said. Don't you think it's the only explanation that makes any sense? It's not an explanation at all. It's only speculation. The baseless kind. This is real life, Adam. Not one of your screenplays or, you know, a movie that's actually been made. Do you know how rare serial killers are? How few of them are out there? Jesus, Rose, we're not talking about Ted Bundy. We're talking about a man who saw the opportunity to kill two women and get away with it and took it. Maybe he has killed other women. I don't know. But how could anyone kill anyone, anywhere, and have no one at all do anything about it? How could that even happen? Think about it. That's just it, Rose. It does happen. Maritime law screws the investigations up. The cruise ship companies don't want anyone to know what's really going on, so they pay people off and keep it quiet. And he knows what he's doing, Rose. This guy, Ethan. We wouldn't even know about him if I hadn't found that phone bill in Sarah's desk drawer. She didn't tell you any details. We didn't even know his name, for God's sake. But that's just it. Sarah was with him. She liked him. Was attracted to him, trusted him enough to go away on a trip with him. Are you saying she would have fallen for a murderer? I know love is blind and all that, but I think she might have noticed. This isn't a fucking joke, Rose. Why are you being like this? Like what? Realistic? Like a bitch. I regretted it before I'd even uttered the ch sound. Sorry, Rose. Look, I'm only trying to help you, she said quietly. I'm sorry. I know. Do you know what you sound like? I hate to say this to you, Adam, but a conspiracy theorist. One of those guys who think man never landed on the moon and 9/11 was an inside job. I think you've been taken in by this guy, and I don't blame you. You're dealing with a lot right now. There are people who prey on the vulnerable. That's why religious cults have a disproportionately high rate of members who have lost a spouse or a family member. Where are you getting all this from? I believe they're called books. Rose, I'm just trying to find out what happened to Sarah. And I'm just trying to stop something from happening to you. Don't you want answers? Of course I do. But am I going to get them from this random guy you met online? What about Sarah reading the WhatsApp message? What about the note? How does that fit into Peter's theory? You said the handwriting on it was definitely hers, and I agree. Ita must have forced them to write them. Maybe at knife point. Then he addressed the envelope, that's why the writing is different, and posted it after he killed her. Rose asked me then when I had last slept. I ignored the question. It couldn't be a coincidence? She asked. Don't even mention that word, Rose. Okay, fine. Well, not to fan the flames of crazy, but let's pretend for a second that this Peter guy is right. What are you going to do now? Find Ethan. And then figure it out, I don't know. Get him to confess, trick him into it, or find evidence against him. Maybe he could have something of hers. Get more information to go back to the Gardaí with, I suppose. But you said the Gardaí have no jurisdiction. Whoever then? I snapped. Rose sighed long and loud. You were there, I said. In that room with Louise, you heard her outside afterwards. There's something going on, and everything Peter says, it fits. Well, if Psycho Peter says it... Rose! He lost his wife! A pause. Right. Sorry. This is all I can do, I said. Isn't it? I mean, what else is there? I can get off the ship and go home and what? Sit and wait. Wait for what? For how long? How long is enough? How am I going to wait? We'll figure it. Adam, I hear Morsi at the door. Why don't you talk to him? Maybe he can... No, I said. It's okay. Tell him I'm okay. But I have to do this. We're about to set sail. Adam, no. Listen. Write this down, Summer. Peter's last name is Brazier. His wife was Estelle. She disappeared last August. You can look up the details online. Tell my parents and Jack and Maureen that I've just come to Barcelona to look around or something, to check the hotel. Don't mention anything about me going on the cruise ship, okay? Or the stuff I just told you. They've got enough to worry about right now. And no point giving them any news until we're 100% sure. Will you please just listen to me for a second? This isn't a good idea. I don't know if there'll be Wi-Fi at sea, but I've seen signs here for internet cafes. I'll check my email when I can, but my phone probably won't work. We'll be in Nice tomorrow and back in Barcelona Thursday morning. In the meantime, maybe you and Morsi can try to find out as much as you can about Ethan. Last name, Eckhart. I spelt it for her. Cusack found him on a website for cruise ship workers, so I bet there's loads more out there. Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Have a search. Email me anything you find. Adam, please just... This is all my fault, Rose. I should have realised sooner that something was badly wrong. Not just after she left, but before, when she was falling for him. There were signs. I can see that now. She was done. She was fed up. I'd had my finger on the pause button for long enough. She didn't want to wait anymore. Adam, it's not... So I have to be there for her now. Be what she needs. More tears were coming. I needed to get off the line. Please understand. I ended the call. While I recomposed myself, I scrolled through my list of recent calls, There were 7 missed calls from Dan. I glanced right and left to see if I was still alone on the path. Then I took a deep breath and hit return.
"Oh, so you're not dead," he said when he picked up. "I'm so glad because..."
I cut him off.
"Dan, I'm going to talk now and you're going to listen. And this time I don't care what you have to say, okay? My girlfriend is missing. I haven't heard from her in over a week. She was supposed to be on a business trip in Barcelona, but I've traced her to a cruise ship off the coast of France, and I just met a man who thinks she might have been murdered. I'm on the ship now, and I'm going to find him, the murderer. The cruise is for 3 nights, 4 days, and it leaves in less than half an hour. Obviously, finishing the rewrites is not on my list of priorities right now, and since I pay you, I'm not interested in hearing your thoughts on that. I don't care about the money. I don't care about my career. All I ever really cared about was this girl, about being with her, about sharing my life with her. Now, I don't know where she is, or how she is, or if she's even alive. I have to find out what happened to her, and I will. First, if the studio is unhappy about this, their options are to fuck off or wait longer. You can tell them that from me. When all this is over, if it ever is, I will call you and tell you that I'm ready. You don't call me. Are we clear?" My palms were so slick with nervous sweat that the phone nearly slid out of my hand while I waited through the silence that followed. But Dan didn't have to know that.
"We're clear," he said eventually. "Good. And I know you're not going to want to hear this, but can I just play the role of the blackened soul here for a second? It'd be a lot easier to get the studio to wait patiently if I told them about this, about what you're going through, because you know what? This has Oscar contender written all over it. It's like Taken meets Gone Girl on a boat, only it's true, and you know how Academy voters love a good true..." I ended the call. Dan had secured a script deal for me, yeah, but it seemed his real talent lay in making me question my career choice. I made my way back outside and looked to see whether Peter was still in the same spot. As I crossed the deck, I felt a faint, brief vibration beneath my feet, followed by a gentle lurch. A cheer went up from the crowd. The Celebrate was sailing away. We met Megan for the first time that night in Fizz, the cocktail bar where Estelle was last seen. From the view through its narrow floor-to-ceiling windows, Fizz must be in the stern. I'd lost all sense of direction on the twisty route here. Though it was still reasonably bright outside, it was dark in the bar, with partial drapes, soft lamps, and recessed spotlights all adding up to barely enough light to read a menu. Everything was purple, from the covers of the menus to the upholstery on the chairs. Peter and I sat at the bar. We ordered hamburgers and cokes from the bartender Javier, whose favourite Blue Wave destination was Stockholm. As he set our drinks down in front of us, Peter said to him, "A friend of ours works here, somewhere. He doesn't know we're on board, and we'd love to surprise him. Maybe you know him. His name's Ethan Eckhart." I kept my expression as neutral as I could, but I was shocked. I hadn't expected Peter to just start throwing the man's name around so soon and so openly. What if Ethan himself was nearby? What if he overheard us? "It doesn't sound familiar, sorry," Javier said. "A lot of people work on this ship." "How many is a lot? Like 1,000? "Our friend works in the food and beverage department. Does that help?" "Not really. F&B is every bar, restaurant, cafe and ice cream stand on the entire ship. Room service too. We have more F&B crew than anything else. I'm sorry, but I think you'll just have to call your friend." "But we really want to surprise him." "I can ask my manager. Maybe he will know." Peter smiled. "That'd be great." Javier disappeared through a purple velvet curtain that must hide a passageway to the kitchens. 1,000 crew, I whispered to Peter. "We've only got 4 days.
Are you sure it's a good idea to be throwing his name around so freely?
You didn't use your friend's blue crew then? A female voice said.
We both turned toward the source, a woman sitting three stools to my right.
I recognized her instantly.
In real life, Megan of Megan's Muster Station seemed older than she did in her YouTube videos. Late 20s to early 30s, if I had to guess. She was slim and pretty, with short blonde hair and a sun-kissed, outdoorsy look. There was a book open on the bar in front of her, but she was smiling at us.
Pardon? Peter said.
His blue crew rate. The American accent was strong now that I knew to listen for it. The Blue Wave employee discount for friends and family. If he doesn't know you're here, I'm guessing you paid the full ticket price.
Oh, yes. Yes, we did, Peter said. Unfortunately, we don't know him that well. He gave a short, odd laugh.
Shame, Megan said.
Mind if I join you?
Not at all.
She moved to the stool beside me and stuck out her hand.
My name's Megan.
Actually, I know, I said. I'm Adam and this is Peter. I think I've seen one of your videos.
Oh, really? God, she blushed. That's embarrassing.
She reached across me to shake Peter's hand. It's fine when you're at home uploading them, but then when I meet a real-life person who's seen them, it's mortifying.
You're British, right?
He is, I said. I'm Irish.
Really? My mother's Irish. Like, has an Irish passport, Irish. She was born in Galway.
Galway's nice.
I must get there someday. What part of Ireland are you from?
Cork, down in the very south.
That's the Titanic place, right?
One of them, yeah. Built in Belfast, sailed from Cork.
You're American? Peter asked her.
Megan laughed.
How'd you guess?
I wasn't sure. I have occasionally made the mistake of saying that to Canadians,
which I bet they love.
There have been some awkward silences, you could say.
Well, I would take offence too, but I guess it's just like the Irish-British thing, right? Sometimes you guys all sound the same to me.
Are you doing one of your videos on here? I asked her.
Megan smirked.
Yep. Busted. I'm on a junket. All expenses paid so long as I post a few videos.
I'm actually not supposed to tell full-price-paying passengers that, but you two look trustworthy.
Nice job to have, Peter said. Do they let you bring someone along?
Unfortunately, no. I'm all on my lonesome. But it's okay. I've just met two really nice guys in Fizz.
She winked at me. I looked at my Coke.
Do they make you say nice things in return? Peter said. On your videos.
Let's just say I wouldn't get invited back if I said anything too nasty. But between you and me, I'll say whatever they want me to say. I make decent money from their affiliate program. I'm saving it up to go back to school.
To do what?
Hospitality management.
So, Megan turned to me.
How do you guys know each other?
I opened my mouth to speak, then realized I was about to say, well, we don't really.
From university, Peter said.
Oh, yeah.
She seemed dubious, probably because, going by appearances, Peter and I would have met at college only if he had been my professor.
He was a mature student, I said.
Javier reappeared through the velvet curtain.
You guys have friends in very high places, huh?
He wagged his finger at us in mock reprimand. I hope you'll only be telling him very good things about me. Tell him I'm the best bartender, okay? Tell him I deserve a raise.
Peter and I looked at each other, perplexed.
Your friend, Javier said. He doesn't work in the F&B department. He runs it. Mr. Eckhart is our food and beverage director.
You didn't know that?
No. No, he didn't, Peter said. We, haven't seen him in a while.
A director? That made sense, given Ethan's age. The average age of all the front-of-house staff we had encountered on the ship so far seemed to be somewhere between old enough to vote and old enough to rent a car. It was like Logan's Run around here. Peter asked where we could find him.
"I don't know for sure," Javier said. "The director doesn't work just in one place. He moves around all the time from restaurant to restaurant. If you want, you can give me a message and I'll..."
"I think we'll try finding him first," Peter said.
"Good luck then. Lots of places to check on here, and you'll be moving around. He'll be moving around." Javier shrugged. "The cruise is only 4 days, guys."
He moved away to serve other passengers.
"You know," Megan said, "you could just ask to speak with him. Go to one of the service desks and do it. You don't have to give your real name. You could even pretend you want to make a complaint. How funny would that be? Imagine his face when he sees you."
I imagined Ethan's face when I told him I was Sarah's boyfriend.
"Yes," Peter said. "That would be something."
"Or," Megan rubbed her hands together like a stage villain, "we could sneak in to the crew quarters."
I froze at the suggestion. Peter asked how.
"I used to work for Royal Caribbean," she said. "I know all the tricks, and they have the best parties back there. Do you know the crew have their own pool?"
"I don't think all three of us could manage it together, but maybe I could sneak one of you in."
She looked at me as she said the last bit.
Megan was flirting with me, I realized. I could feel it, the twinge, the pull of someone else's presence on mine. The subtext. Come with me. Be with me. Stay with me.
"I don't think that headache went away," I said.
"No?"
Peter narrowed his eyes.
"Didn't you take something for it?"
"I did, but I feel it creeping back now."
"I have something in my purse," Megan offered.
"It's okay, I have something in my cabin. I think I'll go get it." I started to slide off my stool.
"I'll see you in the morning," I said to Peter. He just glared at me.
I turned to Megan. "It was nice meeting you."
"Feel better," she said, patting my arm.
"Nice meeting you too."
I was already moving toward the door. Peter was pissed off at me, but I just wanted to get away, because I couldn't do this. I wasn't cut out for this. Breaking into crew quarters? Seriously, me? I was the sort that never stepped beyond the yellow line on the train station platform.
"Adam," Peter had run out after me.
"Wait.
What are you doing?"
"Look, I'm sorry," I said when he caught up. "I just don't want to do this. I don't think I can."
"Do what?"
"Find him. Because this is the finding him bit.
I'm not going to sneak around crew quarters, Peter. We could get thrown off for that."
"That's the worst thing that could happen to you now, is it? Getting thrown off the ship."
I said nothing.
"She's perfect, Adam. Megan is perfect. Come on. This is our lucky break. She knows the ship. She knows the industry. She used to be crew. And she obviously likes you. You should encourage that."
"Encourage what?"
"I'm not talking about doing anything. I mean, you know, let her think what she wants until we find Ethan."
"What are we going to do then? What's the actual plan when we find him?"
I shook my head. "I'm not sure I'm cut out for this. When she said that about going into the crew quarters, Peter, I was..." I didn't want to admit this. I wanted to be stronger, but the truth was, I was scared.
"Of what?
Of him?"
Peter bit his lip, considering.
"Okay, Adam," he said. "Here's what we'll do. You go back to your cabin and rest. I imagine you haven't had much sleep in the past week. You could do with a solid 8 hours. Then in the morning, we'll start systematically searching the restaurants for him. From afar. We'll make sure we see him before he sees us. Once we locate him, I'll confront him. I'll do what needs doing. It's the least I can do.
After all, you've paid for this. I couldn't have afforded to come aboard without you.
It's fine, I said, waving a hand. Don't worry about that.
Talking about who had paid for what was an excruciating torture for me in any circumstance, and this was my point. I was a guy who couldn't face a full and frank discussion about how best to pay for a shared taxi ride home. How in the hell was I supposed to confront a killer?
Good, Peter said. Now, go get some rest. I'll see you bright and early for breakfast.
I sighed with relief as he turned him and back into Fizz. I didn't know what I was going to do in the morning, but I did know that Peter was right. What I needed right now was sleep. My cabin looked just as I had left it. There were no chocolates on the pillow. The Do Not Disturb sign had been heeded. I eyed the bottle of champagne on the desk. With a few glasses of that in me, it would be easy to get the full 8 hours Peter had prescribed. But my eyelids were already drooping. I didn't need it. I went to close the curtains and stopped, looking out at the endless sea shimmering in the moonlight. I couldn't help thinking it. She could be out there somewhere, floating, alone, waiting for someone to believe that she was, waiting for me to find her. I pulled the curtains shut, kicked off my shoes and climbed into bed fully clothed, and let myself sink into thinking about Sarah, about how it felt to fall asleep with her head on my chest, about waking up beside her in the morning, about how, when she came home in the evening, the first thing she always did was come to my desk, wrap her arms around me and say, "Well, did you get much procrastinating done today?" Next thing I knew, it was morning, and the frayed ends of Sarah's navy and white scarf were on the bed beside me, tickling my face.
Romain, Fleury Mérogis, Paris, 2000. Romain sat on the bed his father had bought for him and let his weight sink down into the deep, soft mattress. The new sheets still had creases in them from being folded into their packaging. They smelled clean and fresh. When he skimmed his palms over them, they felt soft and strong, not rough and thin like the ones he was used to. The pillows were thick, and there were three of them. If he piled them up on top of each other, he would practically be sleeping upright. A voice intruded. "Romain?" He opened his eyes. His psychiatrist, Dr. Tanner, was sitting opposite, fingers steepled under his bearded chin, a 6-inch thick patient file on the tabletop in front of him. It had Romain's name on it. "What were you thinking about?" Tanner asked.
"The bed my father is going to have ready for me in my new room."
"Oh, have you seen it?"
"No, but I can imagine it."
"What do you imagine?"
"Something much better than you get in this place."
Tanner looked around and grinned. "For your sake, Romain, I hope so." The chairs they were sitting on and the table between them were the only furniture in the room. Everything was steel-framed and bolted to the floor, its most recent layer of green paint chipped and peeling, the original smoothness of the material interrupted with the bumps and edges of older, deeper coats. The room was small and bare, the walls cinder block, their faded yellow paint pockmarked from old posters and blotched with stains, the only window narrow and secured with a metal grill. Behind Romain was a thick steel door, and behind that an armed guard stood sentry. "You're looking forward to leaving, then?" Dr. Tanner asked. Romain made a face. "Okay, okay," the doctor laughed. "Silly question. I suppose what I was really asking was, are you nervous at all?"
"A little bit," Romain admitted.
"What are you nervous about?"
"Myself. What if it's all still there inside me? What if it comes back up? What if all this hasn't worked?"
"Ah, come now. We've discussed this. It has worked. Which reminds me..." The doctor lifted up the patient file and took from beneath it a printout of several sheets paperclipped together. He passed it to Romain. This is the article. It was published in the journal yesterday. You're famous now. Romain took the pages without mentioning that he was famous already, because Tanner knew that better than anyone. The printout was a photocopy of a long, dense article, Boy P and the Possible Curing of Psychopathy. The headline read, Dr. Gary Tanner on the case study that looks set to rock the foundations of the psychiatry world. Above the text of the article was a large picture of the doctor standing in a garden in front of a big tree, smiling. We are famous, Romain said, tapping the picture. I think there will be far more interest in you than in me. There was a sharp rap of knuckles on the door. A guard stuck his head into the room and said Romain's father was here. Off you go, then, Tanner said. We'll meet again before you leave. Say hi to Charlie for me. Three doors. That was all that stood between Romain and the outside world. The door behind the guard station that led to the corridor, the door at the end of the corridor which led to the main entrance, and the door that separated the inside from the outside. He went through one of them now, into the visitor's room. Only three doors. It was something that Romain thought about often, about what a difference those three doors made, separating the world he experienced from the world everyone else his age did. He hadn't seen the third door, the farthest one, in 5 years. But in 5 days he would be allowed to walk through it. Romain wondered what was going on out there, what he was missing, what he had already missed. An electronic lock buzzed loudly, and his father came into the visitor's room. Right away Romain knew that something was wrong. His father didn't even look into his eyes until he was sitting down at the table and had no choice. Today's visit was supposed to be about finalizing the plan for Romain's release, working out the last few details. What time Papa needed to come pick him up, what food he wanted to eat first, what he wanted to do to celebrate his 18th birthday. Papa was in the process of moving from his apartment into a house. That way there would be enough space for the two of them to live together, yet still have some space of their own. The last time Papa visited, he had asked Romain to make a list of everything he thought he would need. Clothes, toiletries, posters, those kinds of things. Romain had the list in his pocket right now, but he didn't take it out. Something told him not to. Not yet. Hi, Romy, Papa said, giving him a big fake smile. Fake smiles were something Romain could identify now, thanks to Dr. Tanner. Had Papa forgotten that? How are you? Looking forward to the big day? What's wrong, Papa? His father frowned. Who said anything was wrong? He pushed his spectacles back up his nose, glanced back at the guards. What is it? Romain asked. Tell me. I don't know what you mean. I know something is wrong, Papa. You're a terrible liar. You can't do it at all. His father looked as if he was about to argue, but then he changed his mind. Fine. There's been a change, Romy. To the plan, it's your mother. Is she dead? Did something happen to her? What? No. No, she's fine. Why would you? No, it's just, we've been talking about you a lot, about our plans, the plans you and I had. Had. His father noticed that he had noticed, but he pushed on anyway, talking faster now. The thing is, Romy, she's told me that if I take you in, she won't let me see Jean and Mickey anymore. She still thinks, well, you know what she thinks, that it wasn't an accident at the pond. I didn't tell you this before, I know, but I didn't want to upset you. Not when you are doing so well. She and I have been seeing her a lot lately. We go out for dinner, and sometimes Jean comes with us too. Jean is actually living with me for the summer. We are getting along well, very well.
Once all four of us went out for... Four of you is not all of you, Romain said quietly.
No. His father pushed his spectacles up again. They hadn't slipped down, it was just a habit.
No, that's right. I know. I just meant... I can't come live with you. That's what you're here to tell me, isn't it?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that, Romy. Your mother and I have been apart for many years.
You've been apart for as long as I've been in here?
Yes. Yes, we have.
Papa cleared his throat. He was sweating now. Beads of it glistened by his hairline.
Listen, I've always been here for you, and I'll be here for you now. I'm going to find a place for you to live, and one of the guys at work thinks he might have a job for you.
Doing what?
I don't know yet, but he has a farm, so it'll be something to do with the animals, I expect. Would you like that?
How much does it pay?
You don't have to worry about money. I'll take care of you.
Where will I live? Near you?
We might be able to get you something on the farm. That would be convenient, wouldn't it? And you'd be back out in the countryside, which you love.
Where's the farm?
His father waved a hand dismissively.
I don't want you to get fixated on the farm, Romy.
You're the one who said it.
It's only one possibility.
Where is it?
His father hesitated.
Near Soissons, I believe.
Romain knew that Soissons was at least an hour's drive from where his father lived.
Okay, Romain said. I see.
Also...
His father was shifting in his seat now.
Your mother thinks it might be better for everyone if we didn't come pick you up. Now, before you say anything, listen to why she thinks that. There'll be reporters there and photographers. She doesn't want to remind everyone what she looks like. It's only recently that people have stopped recognizing her in the street and at the supermarket.
She doesn't have to come.
But it's better for you, too. You see, if we, or I, don't come for you, you can leave early in the morning before anyone is outside. Sleep out before the press get here. You're a man now, Romy. You look nothing like the boy people remember. Isn't it better for you if people on the street don't know who you are, if they don't recognize you?
She told you, didn't she?
Papa swiped at his forehead.
Told me what?
That's what this is about.
Told me what, Romy?
Where I came from. Who I am. What I am. She only visited me once. Did you know that? Just the one time. The first week I was here. She told me then. Can you believe that? Saying those things to a 12-year-old boy.
I don't.
Papa's voice trailed off, and Romain watched as his eyes moved up and to the left. Dr. Tanner called that accessing a visually constructed image.
I don't know what you mean.
Romain stared at him. He didn't want to push it.
Has she spoken to Dr. Tanner?
He asked.
Many times.
Recently?
Papa said he wasn't sure.
She doesn't believe him. Romy, it's not a case of believing him or not. This is science, and your mother, she's been doing her own research, talking to some of the doctors who don't agree with Tanner. There are many of them, you know. Tanner's treatment is controversial. You're the only one he's treated. The other doctors, they say one person isn't enough to prove anything. Your mother tends to think so, too. So, you're on her side now.
There are no sides, Romy. There never have been. You know that. I'm just trying to keep the peace. I want the best solution for everyone. Don't you see? The best thing you can do is to show her that you're not what she thinks you are. take the job, stay out of trouble, be responsible. Maybe in a year or two we can talk about this again. She might agree to let you come live with us, homie.
His father's voice cracked.
I just want my family back. Do you understand that? I just want my family back. Together, the way we were before. Before all this.
Romain remembered the moment, 6 years earlier, when the verdict was handed down. Guilty of murder. Maman would have been allowed into the court. She'd already given her evidence the trial was over, but she didn't bother to come. Only Papa was there. Before they led Romain away, back to the cells to await transport, Papa had run from his seat, grabbed him by both shoulders, and promised him that he would be there for him on the other side.
"I'm going to make this right," Papa had said, his eyes glistening. "I know it was just an accident. I believe you owe me. I do. Serve your time. You'll be 18 before you know it. Then you and I will make you a new life."
But now, just a few days before Romain was due for release, Papa had suddenly changed his mind. There could be only one explanation for it. Mama had got to him.
"It's okay, Papa,"
Romain said now, pushing his chair back from the table. Hearing the scrape of steel on the concrete floor, one of the guards by the door stepped forward to escort Romain back to his cell.
"It's fine." "What do you mean?"
"You don't need to help me. I understand. I can put myself in your shoes and see what it's like from your perspective. Dr. Tanner taught me that. Do whatever Mama says, okay? I'll be fine. I can manage by myself."
"But I..."
"Really, Papa, it's okay. I mean it."
Romain stood up and walked around the table to Papa's side. Papa stood up too, a little unsure at first, his brow furrowed in confusion. But when Romain moved to embrace him, there was no hesitation. He held Romain tight and whispered into his ear,
"No matter what happens, you'll always be my son. Remember that, Romy. No matter what happens, you will always be my son."
Romain said nothing. He didn't need to see Papa's eyes to know that that was a lie. Romain started his 18th birthday in a cell and ended it on a bunk in a city hostel owned by the prison service. The social worker assigned to him, a woman named Marie, who smelled of dirty clothes and talcum powder, said he could stay there for up to 7 nights, and gave him a small envelope with a few hundred francs inside. It was his money. He had earned it by working in the prison library. She told him to keep it on his person and not to let anyone else know he had it, especially none of the other men in the hostel. Other men sounded so strange. Was he a man now? Romain lay awake all night that first night, staring at the ceiling. He kept one palm pressed against the envelope he had hidden underneath his sweatshirt. All around, strange and unfamiliar sounds threatened him from the dark. There was another envelope hidden behind the first. It contained the handful of creased family photographs he'd had with him in prison, and a real estate agent's flyer for a 3-bedroom, semi-detached house in the Parisian suburbs. Papa had given him the flyer months ago when his offer was accepted. Since then, Romain had handled it so much that the ink began to fade and the paper to separate at the folds, but the street address was still legible. Romain left the hostel at the break of dawn. Signs for the metro sent him around 2 corners and then into a train station with a huge curved roof that let the birds in. There were people everywhere. A café on the main concourse displayed shelves and shelves of pastries that made Romain's mouth water and his stomach growl, but he didn't want to spend any money just yet. He didn't know how long it would have to last him. He could ignore his hunger for a while. He did have to buy a metro ticket. He went to one of the ticket desks because he didn't know how to use the machines and asked for a day pass. The girl behind the desk let him have a student rate even though he had forgotten his student ID. She smiled at him when she handed him the ticket. Remembering what Tanner had told him, Romain smiled back, mirroring her body language. The metro was easy enough to follow, although the noise of it made Romain's head hurt. There was so much going on out here in the world. Traffic, television screens, people talking on phones they carried around with them. He was finding it difficult to concentrate. It was a relief to emerge from the RER station at the end of his journey to find himself on a quiet, leafy suburban street. He found the house easily, not least because the for sale sign was still in the garden. A sold sticker was peeling off it. Keeping his head down, Romain walked past it once or twice, trying to gauge whether anyone was currently inside. There was no car in the driveway, no noise coming from the house. A large window at the front gave him a view of a small, neat sitting room. The TV in the corner was switched off. It appeared that no one was home. Along the side of the house was a narrow alleyway blocked by a wooden gate secured with a padlock. The gate was as tall as Romain. Using a nearby rubbish bin as a step-up, Romain hoisted himself over and dropped down the other side. Around back was a small, mossy patio and a set of patio doors. He tried the handle. Locked. Cupping his hands against the glass, he looked inside. Romain could see a living room with a kitchen at one end. Packing boxes were everywhere, and leaning against the opposite wall was a large framed picture of Maman, Papa, Jean, and Mickey huddled together in front of the castle at Disneyland. There was a sudden burst of music from above Romain's head, something loud and angry, rock with indecipherable lyrics, more noise than music. Romain looked up and saw that a small window on the first floor was cracked open. That's where the music was coming from. But who was playing it? Could it be Jean? The last time Romain had seen Jean, the boy was only 8 years old. He had been sitting on a carpeted floor with shelves of green leather-bound books behind him, playing with his plastic wrestlers, talking about what had happened that day at the pond, testifying against his own brother via video link, the brother who had only been trying to protect him. Did Jean understand that? Did he remember? Or had Maman poisoned his thinking since? Papa was lost to him now, but Romain suddenly had an overwhelming need for Jean to know the truth, to know that he had done what he had done for his little brother. Yes, things had gotten out of hand. Yes, the darkness had slipped out of him for a moment. But Dr. Tanner had taken care of that. He was good now. Romain made his way back to the front of the house and rang the doorbell. He waited nervously for an answer. None came. He rang the bell again. A moment later, he heard movement on the other side of the door. Footsteps on the floor. Boots on wood, it sounded like. A beat of silence, perhaps while someone looked through the peephole. Then, finally, the turn of a lock. The door opened to reveal a tall, thin teenage boy standing in the hall. Not as tall as Romain, but almost. His long, dark hair was disheveled, his face puffy from sleep, the laces on his black boots frayed and loose. "Yeah," he said, squinting in the daylight.
"Jean."
A frown. "Who are you?" Romain had no lie prepared. Perhaps he should have had. Perhaps he shouldn't have gone anywhere near the house until he had some elaborate story all worked out. He was a good liar when he was prepared. It would have worked. It could have. But there was something about Jean, something about the familiar blue eyes of the boy he had known so well now set into a young man's face. It broke open something inside Romain. He thought of that same face at the edge of the pond, the fright the child had gotten when Bastien screamed at him. Earlier than that, Jean asleep on the bunk below in superhero pajamas, his mouth hanging open, back at the house in the countryside, Jean running after him on the path that led to the lake, to their fort, calling his name, begging him to wait. It made him never want to go back to that awful hostel. He didn't want to have to fend for himself. He wanted to come home to his family. He wanted to stop paying for something he had done in one moment of madness back when he was just a boy. So he said, "It's me, Jean. It's Romy. Don't you recognize me?" The look of sleep slid off Jean's face. "I just want to talk to you," Romain said. "That's all. I don't know what Maman has told you, but we're brothers, Jean. Brothers. Nothing changes that. That day by the pond, I was just trying to protect you. I went too far, I know, but that was a mistake. Do you remember that day? Do you remember it, Jean?" Jean took a step backward, tripped on the edge of the doormat, recovered, and took another step. "Jean, wait!" Romain stepped inside. "You don't have to be afraid of me. I won't hurt you. I won't hurt anybody. They cured me. They found out what was wrong and they made it all go away. I'm calling the police." Jean took another step back, retreating toward the kitchen. There was a phone in there. Romain had seen it through the patio doors on the wall by the fridge. "There's no need, Jean. No need for police. It's just me. Romy, I only want to talk to you. We can talk about the day by the pond if you..."
"Stop calling it that!" Jean shouted suddenly. "The day by the pond. You murdered a child, you fucking psycho. You held him under the water until he stopped fighting and drowned."
"I thought you said you didn't."
"I know what happened. The whole country knows what happened."
"It was an accident. I didn't mean to."
"Didn't mean to kill him when you pushed him underwater and held him there. What did you think was going to happen? Did you think he had gills?"
Romain felt the situation slipping away from him. Things weren't going according to plan. He should leave. But he couldn't let Jean call the police. He could say Romain had broken in or tried to attack him, and then, before you knew it, Romain would be back in jail. Adult jail, now that he was 18. Romain took another step forward, Jean another back.
"I was only a child," Romain said. "A child. If you'd just let me explain."
"What's your excuse for Mickey, then? Was that an accident, too?"
"Yes, it was."
"That's not what Maman says."
"You can't believe everything she says, Jean."
"Oh, but I can believe everything you tell me. The convicted child murderer. The certified psychopath."
Jean turned and ran, disappearing through the open door at the end of the hall and into the living room. But he went right instead of left, away from the phone. Then Romain remembered. Mobile phones. Papa said lots of people had them now. Did that include teenagers? A wailing siren startled him. The house alarm. Jean had tripped it, which was actually quite clever of him, Romain had to admit. He covered the rest of the hall in just a few strides, reaching the living room just as the patio door smacked loudly against its frame. Jean had gone outside. Romain followed him into the garden, picking up his pace now. The alarm company would be calling the house any second, and if nobody picked up and said the right words, the police would arrive soon. He should leave. Right now. But... convicted child murderer. Certified psychopath. He had to talk to Jean first, had to make him listen. There was no sign of him at the back of the house, but there was only one.